So Haggai the prophet comes at a time when the people are flowing back from the Babylonian captivity. They've been in exile for 7 decades in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley in Mesopotamia after the conquest of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. And the people begin to return to Jerusalem, and the process begins of rebuilding the temple. And one of the things that God asks the people through Haggai the prophet is, what do you think about the new temple? Some of you are old enough to have been small children and have seen the temple of Solomon before the Babylonians destroyed it. How do you see it now? Is the new one not as nothing by comparison? But be strong and work, for I am with you. So as the church turned to the Middle Ages, particularly in the West, and the Western Roman Empire has collapsed, we went through a process in the Eastern Empire that was a little bit like this, in the sense that that people began to believe that God was going to rebuild the thing that had been, that the empire was coming back, and the empire, having been converted to Christianity, would be the whole would be the means by which God did what he was going to do. So next slide, Justinian, a man named Justinian, becomes the emperor in Constantinople. And Justinian is noteworthy for a whole list of reasons, but one of them is that he successfully reconquered most of what had been the Roman Empire. And for some 3 decades and a little bit beyond, it seemed like the former glory had returned, and that the dark things that Augustine had written in the City of God about the coming of the barbarian hordes and the need for the church to be separate from the state, maybe that stuff wasn't really true. Maybe God was going to restore the empire and use the empire as the means of expanding his church. And so Justinian is often known as Justinian the Great. And this picture of Justinian is really significant in this conversation, because this is a mosaic from the Church of San Vitale at Ravenna, right here in northeastern Italy. And this mosaic was made during Justinian's lifetime. It was almost certainly made by an artist who had seen Justinian face to face and actually knew what he looked like. And so all the way along in this, I keep putting up pictures of people, but the pictures are done by artists centuries later. This is the first time that we have an image of someone that was done contemporaneously, that was done in their lifetime by an artist who actually saw them face to face. And so this isn't an artist looking at, you know, listening to people say, this is what this guy was like. This is an artist who actually went and looked at Justinian, saw his face, and then went and built this mosaic, which still exists today. And so it's the first picture in this whole story that we have that we know is pretty much what the person really looked like. Everything else is based on tradition and stories and the passed down and what other people said and that sort of thing. In many cases, what the artist believes, what the artist is pushing back into the past. One of the things that you'll notice about European art that's associated with the church is, up until the time of the Renaissance, most European art makes people from certainly the biblical era, the New Testament era, look like they lived in the times that the artist lived in. You know, the Dutch masters, when they paint biblical scenes, make it look like Judea is pretty much like Holland, and that people of Judea dress the way that the people of Holland did during the period that that those paintings were made. And so you have a lot of biblically themed art that has really non-Middle Eastern, non-contemporaneous kinds of clothing and architecture and that sort of stuff. But Justinian, here's an image of Justinian that is from his lifetime and probably done by somebody who actually had seen him. So Justinian, born 482 and died in 565. And so he's born, some decades after the Roman Empire in the West has fallen, and born some decades after Augustine of Hippo has written his great Confessions and the City of God. Justinian becomes emperor in 527 and serves from 527 until his death in 568. So it's about 38 years he is the emperor in Constantinople. And before he was the emperor, he was sort of the right-hand man to the previous emperor, a guy named Justin, who was a fairly elderly man, and who may have died of something like kind of Alzheimer's disease or something. Justin, in his last couple of years as emperor, there's a lot of reasons to believe that he wasn't entirely mentally there. In any case, Justin made some significant changes to the law that benefited Justinian very significantly once Justinian became the emperor. One of the changes that Justin made to the law was Justin made a change to the law late in his time as emperor that said basically the next emperor could marry whoever he wanted, even if she was a commoner or was from a less than nice background. Justinian became emperor and almost immediately married a woman named Theodora, who was a notorious actress. And before about the 19th century, the term actress, going back two millennia, is mostly a code for something else other than performing on the stage. In any case, if Justin hadn't changed the law, Justinian would not have been able to marry her. In any case, they remained very happily married until her death. They had no children, but she became a great paragon of the church over the next few decades. In the 20 or so years that they were married, she was a great supporter of key elements of the church, gave great amounts of money and property to the church, and invested herself in the church in such significant ways that in both the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, she is regarded as a saint today. And she is on the list of saints, as is Justinian. So, but Justinian, the big thing that he is remembered for is when he became the emperor, the empire had Greece and this piece here and Asia Minor and down through here into Egypt and down to about here. And that was the whole empire that he inherited. And he initiated military campaigns that conquered all of North Africa, destroyed the Vandal Kingdom, invaded and conquered part of southern Iberia, what is now southern Spain, seizing that from the Visigoth Kingdom, conquered and destroyed the Ostrogoth Kingdom in what is now Italy, and retook Rome and Ravenna for the empire, and launched an invasion up here in Slavic territory to the northeast of the Black Sea in an area that the Roman government had never before held. And so His military campaigns were hugely successful and conquered much of what had been the Roman Empire two centuries before. He didn't need to conquer what is now France in this part of Western Germany, which was the kingdom of the Franks, because the Franks had been converted to the faith under King Clovis a few decades before. And so the Franks were regarded as allies. And last week we talked about in what is now the British Isles, Patrick comes from what is now England and goes to Ireland and becomes the great evangelist of Ireland. Augustine, not the Augustine of Hippo, but a different Augustine, comes from Rome and re-evangelizes the southern part of England and becomes the first Archbishop of Canterbury. And Columba comes out of Ireland and begins the evangelization of Scotland. And so all that is going on during this period. The Lombards are the new tribal people that have been pushed west and come out of Asia. They will eventually conquer a big piece of northern Italy, and which is why a big piece of northern Italy is now called Lombardy. Okay, you saw that one coming, right? The Visigoth kingdom is the last of the barbarian kingdoms that overran the Western Roman Empire that remains. So, hugely successful in reconquest of the larger part of the former Roman Empire. First of all, Justinian wasn't a military man and almost never went on campaign. He didn't lead his own armies. He didn't devise much of his own campaigns. He thought strategically and sent generals out to do what he thought needed to be done. He had a couple of very excellent generals. One of his generals, Belisarius, is still remembered and studied today. Belisarius is a guy who led the conquest of the western part of northern Africa and then the destruction of the Ostrogoth kingdom in what is now Italy. He's the guy that took Rome back and Ravenna for the empire. But these were hugely costly wars. And although Belisarius was a great general, he was not particularly efficient with the use of blood and treasure in the things that he did. His campaigns resulted in a lot of deaths and a lot of costs. In fact, this whole area of Western Africa, by the end of this conquest, is significantly depopulated. Most of the Vandal people are killed through the process of this, and you're left with a lot of empty space, a lot of untilled fields and towns and small cities that have no people in them. So Justinian's stuff is hugely costly. He was a phenomenally effective administrator. So he created a very highly efficient system of taxation. He was able to keep the income flowing to pay his huge costs. But in Italy, this, you know, it's easy to draw lines on the map and say, oh, look, you know, all the stuff that he conquered. But there's a lot of ebb and flow here during this era. Italy, you know, driving up and down and back and forth, and fighting goes on for several decades. Milan, which had become the capital of the Western Empire when Rome no longer seemed like the right place, Milan on the south side of the Alps at the key east, west, north, south intersection there, was besieged and eventually demolished in the course of this. And Justinian had to pay to rebuild the city basically from scratch. Rome was besieged a couple of times. And in the midst of this, for about the seven-year period from 542 to 549, there's a plague. For the first time in three centuries, there's a plague that sweeps across the Mediterranean world. And this is the bubonic plague. This is not the German measles or the smallpox, as in the 2nd century and the 3rd century. The 6th century plague is the bubonic plague, and it kills more than 10% of the people in the entire empire. Wow, all these wars and this great expansion is going on, which leads to a shortage of manpower, a shortage of men for the army, and tremendous difficulties making ends meet in terms of the tax base. In the midst of this, Justinian also puts together a secret agent-y, Mission Impossible kind of thing, where some monks go to Central Asia and smuggle back silkworms, which, of course, was something that the Eastern empires guarded the production of silk very, very closely. It was hugely economically important. And so the exporting of silkworms was a capital offense, but some guys smuggled out silkworms and brought them back to Constantinople, and Constantinople began producing silk for the next 900 years, and it became a significant part of the economy of what we think of now as the Byzantine Empire. Justinian also spent time rewriting the legal code. He brought the Roman legal code back, all the pieces back together, reorganized the whole thing, it became known as the Justinian Code, the Code of Justinian, the civil law, and he used that to outlaw a lot of pagan practices. He didn't outlaw paganism, but he did use that to outlaw a lot of pagan practices. And the Justinian Code is noteworthy because it's one of the first times in the ancient world that somebody tried to put into law, into the civil code, protections for women. And Justinian, as a Christian, was very strongly of the opinion, or at least his wife was, that the law should protect the rights of women and protect the status of women. And so the Justinian Code has specific laws against exploiting women, against forcing women into prostitution, treats rape as a very serious crime that requires a very serious punishment. Instituted a requirement that women who were imprisoned would be guarded by other women to prevent abuse in that. That women who were widows would have their dowries returned, so they would have money. And actually encoded in the law a requirement that said if a husband wants to take on a major debt, he must get his wife's consent twice. She must say yes twice on two different occasions before he can take on this major debt. So that became part of Justinian's law code. The Justinian Code remained the code of the Eastern Empire until Constantinople fell in 1453. So for some nine centuries, this remains the law code of the Eastern Empire. And beyond that, is actually the basis for the codes of law, the systems of law today in Greece and in Serbia, which, of course, are places that are hugely influenced by the Eastern Empire. In the West, Justinian's code was lost for about five centuries. When it was rediscovered after the turn of the millennia, it became increasingly influential. And by the 1500s, it was the basis for many things in Europe, including much of the Roman Catholic Church's canon law, now looked to Justinian's code as its basis. Napoleon wrote a law code when he was the Emperor of France, and much of what he wrote he cribbed from Justinian. The Napoleonic Code is largely based on Justinian's law, and the Napoleonic Code, of course, remains the basis of law in both France and what U.S. state uses Napoleon's code, which is based on Justinian's? Louisiana. Louisiana. The law of the state of Louisiana traces its way back to Justinian through Napoleon. So huge influence as a lawmaker, lawgiver. He is, the U.S. Supreme Court has great lawgivers on the facade of the court. Moses, of course, is up there, and so is Justinian, as great paragons of the creation of the law. Justinian was a huge builder. He built dams and bridges and did water projects and built government buildings all across the empire. But primarily he is known for the building of churches and cathedrals, which were basically donations from the government to the church. And the greatest of which is the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. But both in Constantinople, Ravenna, Rome, Justinian built or renovated great churches, and was a huge impact on architecture, particularly in the East. Strategically, you know, the Franks are regarded as allies because they're Christians. There's some Christianizing going here. The Visigoth kingdom is hanging on. The Lombards are a growing threat. The Persian Empire, the Sassanid Persian Empire, the Eastern Empire, and Eastern Byzantine Empire is redundant, right? There is no Western Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire is the Eastern Empire. But this, the Persian-Byzantine border here, constant warfare for decades and decades and decades, through the whole time of Justinian, for a couple of decades before and for some decades after, this remains at war. And these tribal peoples around the edges are regarded as basically barbarians who are unconverted and who strategically are of no particular consequence. That will turn out to not be true within less than a century. So one of those groups of tribal people will rise up and conquer almost everything. Justinian also saw himself very much as following Constantine as the steward of the church. He saw himself as a Christian emperor who had responsibility over the church. And so the patriarch, the great bishop of Constantinople, Justinian felt that man basically worked for him, and that his responsibility was to get the bishops of the church to agree. Well, the great disagreement that was on the table and had been for decades was the Council of Chalcedon back in AD 451 had run aground over the question of who is Jesus? What does that really mean? And the specific question of is Jesus God incarnate whose nature is divine and whose human self is basically only a shell or a representation, but whose nature is fundamentally that of God? Or is Jesus both God and man, with both a divine nature and a human nature, and that these two natures are together but not wholly fused? So this question is the question that broke up the Council of Chalcedon, because that Jesus has one nature and it is divine, and he is divine, and the human part of him is not that important, became the position of most of the churches to the east of Constantinople. And the position that Jesus is both divine and human and has two natures which are connected and interrelated but not totally fused together, that are still distinct, became the position of almost all the churches to the west of Constantinople. And this had been going on for some seven decades when Justinian became emperor, and Justinian saw himself as the guy who needed to make the church one, to be unified. And so he took it upon himself to hold a series of meetings and councils to get the church to work this out and come to an agreement. Because as the emperor, he felt like he was empowered to impose a solution, to get all the bishops in the room and say, look, I want you guys to pray, I want you guys to talk, I want you guys to look in the Word, I want you to come to an answer, and I want you all to agree. Anyway, he kept having meetings and they kept not agreeing. And his attempts to impose some kind of solution on this failed utterly. But he put a lot of time and energy into trying to get the bishops from across the church to all agree. And in support of this, he very actively suppressed people that he thought were heretics, people that he thought were outside what the church should be teaching, and became increasingly focused on the church within the boundaries of the empire. And began to ignore, he had issues with the fact that there was a significant church in the Persian Empire and the Persians were his enemies. And yet there was a significant church there. And he knew that there was a significant church in the Frankish Empire, but that was kind of far away. And he did not feel like that was, increasingly he began to feel that that was not very much his business. So he began to focus on the church within the empire and make the church an imperial church that was under the control of the emperor. Since Justinian didn't have any children and didn't have any particular direct heir, his successors didn't necessarily follow the things that he had laid down. His successors were all men who were known to be Christians or believed to be Christians. But this began a long period where the emperor in Constantinople, the new emperor, was often unrelated to the old emperor. And this led to a lot of politicking. And this is why we talk about Byzantine politics anymore, because a lot of emperors became poisoned or otherwise removed so that somebody else could get in. But many of his successors seem to have assumed that the glory days of the empire had returned, that having conquered all this territory, that it would be pretty easy to hold it. And that didn't turn out to be true at all. His successors engaged in very costly wars, as Justinian had, but Justinian's wars produced tax revenue. produced conquered territory, produced safety that allowed for economic activity across the Western Mediterranean. His successors engaged in wars that mostly failed and mostly did not produce value, particularly in terms of tax revenue. Justinian was very good at administration, collecting taxes. The decades after Justinian saw significant decline in administrative capacity, in administrative effectiveness of the government of the Eastern Empire. Taxation, tax collection became ineffective. There was a huge growth in corruption. Government services became fairly poor, and the empire entered an age of decline. Today we look at Justinian's reign and think of it as sort of a blip of a brief moment of glory in a long story of decline. But one thing, next slide, one point of glory that remains, Justinian built churches, and the most amazing church that he built was Hagia Sophia, the Church of Holy Wisdom being the Logos, the Living Word. This is the Church of the Living Word, the Church of Jesus. This church in Constantinople has a great dome and two half domes on either side. It's built on four great piers, on the four kind of corners that the dome is constructed on. And it's different than almost any church that had been built before. This was built between 532 and 537, early in the reign of Justinian. And until that time, churches that have been built in the old Roman Empire almost always were built on the basilica model, the long, narrow, with columns and side aisles, and the altar up at the front. This is not like that. This is basically a square church under a big dome with side elements that allow you to look into the middle. This is a church where the worship happens in the center, under the center of the dome, surrounded by the people. This is a church in the round. This is a really different way of building and thinking about a church. And so it creates a space where all the focus is to the center, and where there's a great open center, and the Word, the Bible, the great book, would be processed in ceremonially at the beginning of the service. And it would process in and come through the assembled people, held up high, and people would reach out to touch the great Bible that they carried in and carried down to the bishop in the center. And later, at the time of the communion elements would be processed into the church, and they would be carried through the congregation and to the middle, and people all around would see these things coming in. The bishop would preside from the middle. And this created even more of a sense that the service, the worship, the Eucharist, particularly the communion service, was a drama being played out in front of this audience. And in this kind of a situation, this is the interior of Hagia Sophia recently. You know, you've got, after in 1453, of course, it was immediately converted into a mosque when the Arab Muslims eventually finally conquered Constantinople. And so you've got Islamic stuff up here. And most of the Christian imagery has either been removed or painted over or plastered over. But it is still a fabulously beautiful interior. And so here's the underside of the Great Dome, and here's the Half Dome on one side. And you can see, you know, there's a great chandelier that hangs down here, and, you know, windows on both ends. But, you know, fantastically beautiful, and windows. Windows up high, windows down low, windows around the edge of the dome. It was amazingly well lighted for a building of the ancient world. The amount of light that comes into the building is really, really impressive. When the building was finished, Justinian reportedly said, "Solomon, I have surpassed you." So, anyway. So, this is one of the reasons why later on Dante assigns Justinian to a level in his story where Justinian is assigned to the level of people who did the right thing, but potentially for the wrong reasons. Because Justinian did a lot of stuff that we think of as right, but potentially did a lot of it because it was made him look good, made him look famous. And this building, by the way, the exterior of it, most of this is actually unfinished now. When it was originally built, Justinian had the exterior clad entirely in white marble. So think of this building as entirely white on the outside. Entirely, all the white marble, almost all of it has been pried off in the years since and used for other things or sold off or whatever. But it was originally clad entirely in white marble. Because it was a white building, you could see it for miles. And those who approached Constantinople in ships, it was the first thing that they could see. It was the great white cathedral looming over the city. So the original design wasn't quite right. So built between 532 and 537. In the 550s, there were a couple of earthquakes. And one of the things the earthquakes proved was that the dome design wasn't quite right. One of the half domes on the side collapsed in one of those earthquakes. And Justinian brought a bunch of people in and said, "What's going on here?" And they decided that the domes were too flat. And so they rebuilt the dome and the half domes in the 550s, between 558 and 562, and built the domes taller. So, and they have stood without incident ever since. But this became the model for church architecture in the East. People came to Hagia Sophia and said, "This is what a church is supposed to look like. This is glorious and amazing." After the conquest of Constantinople in the 1450s, the Ottoman Empire, for the next three centuries, most of the mosques that were built in the Ottoman Empire from 1450 till about 1750 use this as a model. They just build something that's like it, but small. But this becomes the building. The thing. It's the seat, longtime seat of the Patriarch of Constantinople, and was the place that Byzantine emperors were invested, had their coronations, that sort of stuff. At the time it was built, it was the world's largest interior space. There was no building in the world that had more interior space than Hagia Sophia, and that was true for centuries. For nearly 1,000 years, this was the largest cathedral in the world. We're into the 1500s before a cathedral in Spain is a little bit larger than Hagia Sophia, which by that time is a mosque anyway. So Hagia Sophia was a museum between 1935 and 2020, and has since gone back to being a mosque. But Justinian the Great, huge mark on architecture, and one of the great wonders of the church from an architectural standpoint. Justinian also built St. Catherine's Monastery out in the Sinai. It's at the foot of the mountain where Moses is believed to have received the law. That monastery has been in continuous operation since Justinian founded it, because it's in an isolated place in the Sinai and a lot of stuff has passed it by. But St. Catherine still exists today. It became, over the next centuries, a very important link between the East and the West and very pivotal in the preservation of a lot of ancient texts. So